Welcome to the Public Domain Podcast. This week we're continuing the novel The Woman in White by Wilkie Collins. This will be the 7th podcast for the novel. If you've missed other parts, you can download them at publicdomainpodcast.blogspot.com. There is a bit of a break between podcasts, and I do want to apologize for that. I think it's got a little busy with other projects, and I wasn't able to record at that time. But I do appreciate the emails that came in. Thank you very much for them. And I will continue with the podcast at a more regular pace. I promise that I will finish the novel no matter what. And also, I look forward to reading a lot of other novels and short stories that I hope to share with you. To catch up where we're at in the novel, Mr. Hartwright was at Limeridge House and has finally met all its occupants and is about to go out to the countryside with Miss Halcombe and the lovely Miss Fairlie. We merely waited to rouse good Mrs. Vesey from the place which she still occupied at the deserted luncheon table before we entered the open carriage for our promised drive. The old lady and Miss Halcombe occupied the back seat, and Miss Fairlie and I sat together in front, with the sketchbook open between us, fairly exhibited at last to my professional eyes. All serious criticism on the drawings, even if I had been disposed to volunteer it, was rendered impossible by Miss Halcombe's lively resolution to see nothing but the ridiculous side of the fine arts, as practiced by herself, her sister, and ladies in general. I can remember the conversation that passed far more easily than the sketches that I mechanically looked over. That part of the talk, especially, in which Miss Fairlie took any share, is still as vividly impressed on my memory as if I had heard it only a few hours ago. Yes, let me acknowledge that on this first day I let the charm of her presence lure me from the recollection of myself and my position. The most trifling of the questions that she put to me on the subject of using her pencil and mixing her colors, the slightest alterations of expression in the lovely eyes that looked into mine with such an earnest desire to learn all that I could teach, and to discover all that I could show, attracted more of my attention than the finest view we passed through, or the grandest changes of light and shade, as they flowed into each other over the waving moorland and the level beach. At any time, and under any circumstances of human interest, is it not strange to see how little real hold the objects of the natural world amid which we live can gain on our hearts and minds? We go to nature for comfort in trouble, and sympathy in joy only in books. Admiration of those beauties of the inanimate world, which modern poetry so largely and so eloquently describes, is not, even in the best of us, one of the original instincts of our nature. As children, we none of us possess it. No uninstructed man or woman possesses it. Those whose lives are most exclusively passed amid the ever-changing wonders of sea and land are also those who are most universally insensible to every aspect of nature not directly associated with the human interest of their calling. Our capacity of appreciating the beauties of the earth we live on is, in truth, one of the civilized accomplishments which we all learn as an art. And more, that very capacity is rarely practiced by any of us except when our minds are most indolent and most unoccupied. How much share have the attractions of nature ever had in the pleasurable or painful interest and emotions of ourselves or our friends? What space do they ever occupy in the thousand little narratives of personal experience which pass every day by word of mouth from one of us to the other? All that our minds can compass, all that our hearts can learn, can be accomplished with equal certainty, equal profit, and equal satisfaction to ourselves, in the poorest as in the richest prospect that the face of the earth can show. There is surely a reason for this want of inborn sympathy between the creature and the creation around it. A reason which may perhaps be found in the widely differing destinies of man and his earthly sphere. The grandest mountain prospect that the eye can range over is appointed to annihilation. The smallest human interest that the pure heart can feel is appointed to immortality. We had been out nearly 3 hours when the carriage again passed through the gates of Limeridge House. On our way back, I had let the ladies settle for themselves the first point of view which they were to sketch, under my instructions, on the afternoon of the next day, when they withdrew to dress for dinner. And when I was alone again in my little sitting-room, my spirits seemed to leave me on a sudden. I felt ill at ease and dissatisfied with myself. I hardly knew why. Perhaps I was now conscious for the first time of having enjoyed our drive too much in the character of a guest, and too little in the character of a drawing-master. Perhaps that strange sense of something wanting, either in Miss Fairlie or in myself, which had perplexed me when I was first introduced to her, haunted me still. Anyhow, it was a relief to my spirits when the dinner hour called me out of my solitude and took me back to the society of the ladies of the house. I was struck, on entering the drawing-room, by the curious contrast, rather in material than in color, of the dresses which they now wore. While Mrs. Vesey and Miss Halcombe were richly clad, each in the manner most becoming to her age, the first in silver gray, and the second in that delicate primrose yellow color which matches so well with the dark complexion and black hair, Miss Fairlie was unpretendingly and almost poorly dressed in plain white muslin. It was spotlessly pure, it was beautifully put on, but still it was the sort of dress which the wife or daughter of a poor man might have worn, and it made her, so far as externals went, look less affluent in circumstances than her own governess. At a later period, when I learnt to know more of Miss Fairlie's character, I discovered that this curious contrast, on the wrong side, was due to her natural delicacy of feeling and natural intensity of aversion to the slightest personal display of her own wealth. Neither Mrs. Vesey nor Miss Halcombe could ever induce her to let the advantage in dress desert the two ladies who were poor to lean to the side of the one lady who was rich. When the dinner was over, we returned together to the drawing-room. Although Mr. Fairlie, emulating the magnificent condescension of the monarch who had picked up Titian's brush for him, had instructed his butler to consult my wishes in relation to the wine that I might prefer after dinner, I was resolute enough to resist the temptation of sitting in solitary grandeur among bottles of my own choosing, and sensible enough to ask the ladies' permission to leave the table with them habitually, on the civilized foreign plan, during the period of my residence at Limeridge House. The drawing-room, to which we had now withdrawn for the rest of the evening, was on the ground floor, and was of the same shape and size as the breakfast-room. Large glass doors at the lower end open on to a terrace, beautifully ornamented along its whole length with a profusion of flowers. The soft, hazy twilight was just shading leaf and blossom alike into harmony with its own sober hues as we entered the room, and the sweet evening scent of the flowers met us with its fragrant welcome through the open glass doors. Good Mrs. Vesey, always the first of the party to sit down, took possession of an armchair in a corner, and dozed off comfortably to sleep. At my request, Miss Fairlie placed herself at the piano. As I followed her to a seat near the instrument, I saw Miss Halcombe retire into a recess of one of the side windows, to proceed with the search through her mother's letters by the last quiet rays of the evening light. How vividly that peaceful home picture of the drawing-room comes back to me while I write. From the place where I sat, I could see Miss Halcombe's graceful figure, half of it in soft light, half in mysterious shadow, bending intently over the letters in her lap, while, nearer to me, the fair profile of the player at the piano was just delicately defined against the faintly deepening background of the inner wall of the room. Outside, on the terrace, the clustering flowers and long grasses and creepers waved so gently in the light evening air that the sound of their rustling never reached us. The sky was without a cloud, and the dawning mystery of moonlight began to tremble already in the region of the eastern heaven. The sense of peace and seclusion soothed all thought and feeling into a rapt, unearthly repose, and the balmy quiet that deepened ever with the deepening light seemed to hover over us with a gentler influence still, when there stole upon it from the piano the heavenly tenderness of the music of Mozart. It was an evening of sights and sounds never to forget. We all sat silent in the places we had chosen, Mrs. Vesey still sleeping, Miss Fairlie still playing, Miss Halcombe still reading, till the light failed us. By this time the moon had stolen round to the terrace, and soft, mysterious rays of light were slanting already across the lower end of the room. The change from the twilight obscurity was so beautiful that we banished the lamps, by common consent, when the servant brought them in, and kept the large room unlighted, except by the glimmer of the two candles at the piano. For half an hour more the music still went on. After that, the beauty of the moonlight view on the terrace tempted Miss Fairlie out to look at it, and I followed her. When the candles at the piano had been lighted, Miss Halcombe had changed her place, so as to continue her examination of the letters by their assistance. We left her, on a low chair, at one side of the instrument, so absorbed over her reading that she did not seem to notice when we moved. We had been out on the terrace together, just in front of the glass doors, hardly so long as 5 minutes, I should think, and Miss Fairly was, by my advice, just tying her white handkerchief over her head as a precaution against the night air, when I heard Miss Halcombe's voice, low, eager, and altered from its natural lively tone, pronounce my name. "Mr. Hartwright," she said, "will you come here for a minute? I want to speak to you." I entered the room again immediately. The piano stood about halfway down along the inner wall. On the side of the instrument farthest from the terrace, Miss Halcombe was sitting with the letters scattered on her lap, and with one in her hand selected from them, and held close to the candle. On the side nearest to the terrace there stood a low ottoman, on which I took my place. In this position I was not far from the glass doors, and I could see Miss Fairly plainly, as she passed and repassed the opening on the terrace, walking slowly from end to end of it in the full radiance of the moon. "I want you to listen while I read the concluding passages in this letter," said Miss Halcombe. "Tell me if you think they throw any light upon your strange adventure on the road to London. The letter is addressed by my mother to her second husband, Mr. Fairly, and the date refers to a period of between 11 and 12 years since. At that time, Mr. and Mrs. Fairly and my half-sister Laura had been living for years in this house, and I was away from them, completing my education at a school in Paris." She looked and spoke earnestly, and, as I thought, a little uneasily as well. At the moment when she raised the letter to the candle before beginning to read it, Miss Fairly passed us on the terrace, looked in for a moment, and seeing that we were engaged, slowly walked on. Miss Halcombe began to read as follows. "You will be tired, my dear Philip, of hearing perpetually about my schools and my scholars. Lay the blame, pray, on the dull uniformity of life at Limeridge, and not on me. Besides, this time I have something really interesting to tell you about a new scholar. You know old Mrs. Kemp at the village shop? Well, after years of ailing, the doctor has at last given her up, and she is dying slowly day by day. Her only living relation, a sister, arrived last week to take care of her. The sister comes all the way from Hampshire. Her name is Mrs. Catherick. 4 days ago, Mrs. Catherick came here to see me, and brought her only child with her, a sweet little girl about a year older than our darling Laura." As the last sentence fell from the reader's lips, Miss Fairly passed us on the terrace once more. She was softly singing to herself one of the melodies which she had been playing earlier in the evening. Miss Halcombe waited till she had passed out of sight again, and then went on with the letter. "Mrs. Catherick is a decent, well-behaved, respectable woman, middle-aged, and with the remains of having been moderately, only moderately, nice-looking. There is something in her manner and in her appearance, however, which I can't make out. She is reserved about herself, to the point of downright secrecy, and there is a look in her face, I can't describe it, which suggests to me that she has something on her mind. She is altogether what you would call a walking mystery. Her errand at Limeridge House, however, was simple enough. When she left Hampshire to nurse her sister, Mrs. Kemp, through her last illness, she had been obliged to bring her daughter with her, through having no one at home to take care of the little girl. Mrs. Kemp may die in a week's time, or may linger on for months, and Mrs. Catherick's object was to ask me to let her daughter, Anne, have the benefit of attending my school, subject to the condition of her being removed from it to go home again with her mother, after Mrs. Kemp's death. I consented at once, and when Laura and I went out for our walk, we took the little girl, who was just 11 years old, to the school that very day." Once more Miss Fairly's figure, bright and soft in its snowy muslin dress, her face prettily framed by the white folds of the handkerchief which she had tied under her chin, passed by us in the moonlight. Once more Miss Halcombe waited till she was out of sight, and then went on. "I have taken a violent fancy, Philip, to my new scholar, for a reason which I mean to keep till the last, for the sake of surprising you. Her mother having told me as little about the child as she told me of herself, I was left to discover, which I did on the first day when we tried her at lessons, that the poor little thing's intellect is not developed as it ought to be at her age. Seeing this, I had her up to the house the next day, and privately arranged with the doctor to come and watch her and question her, and tell me what he thought. His opinion is that she will grow out of it, but he says her careful bringing up at school is a matter of great importance just now, because her unusual slowness in acquiring ideas implies an unusual tenacity in keeping them, when they are once received into her mind. Now, my love, you must not imagine, in your offhand way, that I have been attaching myself to an idiot. This poor little Anne Catherick is a sweet, affectionate, grateful girl, and says the quaintest, prettiest things, as you shall judge by instance, in the most oddly sudden, surprised, half-frightened way. Although she is dressed very neatly, her clothes show a sad want of taste in color and pattern. So I arranged yesterday that some of our darling Laura's old white frocks and white hats should be altered for Aunt Catherine, explaining to her that little girls of her complexion looked neater and better all in white than in anything else. She hesitated and seemed puzzled for a minute, then flushed up and appeared to understand. Her little hand clasped mine suddenly. She kissed it, Philip, and said, oh so earnestly, I shall always wear white as long as I live. It will help me to remember you, ma'am, and to think that I am pleasing you still when I go away and see you no more. This is only one specimen of the quaint things she says so prettily. Poor little soul! She shall have a stock of white frocks made with good deep tucks to let out for her as she grows. Miss Halcombe paused and looked at me across the piano. "Did the forlorn woman whom you met in the high road seem young?" she asked. "Young enough to be 2 or 3 and 20? "Yes, Miss Halcombe, as young as that." "And she was strangely dressed from head to foot, all in white." "All in white." While the answer was passing my lips, Miss Fairlie glided into view on the terrace for the third time. Instead of proceeding on her walk, she stopped, with her back turned towards us, and, leaning on the balustrade of the terrace, looked down into the garden beyond. My eyes fixed upon the white gleam of her muslin gown and headdress in the moonlight, and a sensation, for which I can find no name, a sensation that quickened my pulse and raised a fluttering at my heart, began to steal over me. "All in white," Miss Halcombe repeated. "The most important sentences in the letter, Mr. Hartwright, are those at the end, which I will read to you immediately. But I can't help dwelling a little upon the coincidence of the white costume of the woman you met, and the white frocks which produced that strange answer from my mother's little scholar. The doctor may have been wrong when he discovered the child's defect of intellect, and predicted that she would grow out of them. She may never have grown out of them, and the old grateful fancy about dressing in white, which was a serious feeling to the girl, may be a serious feeling to the woman still." I said a few words in answer. I hardly know what. All my attention was concentrated on the white gleam of Miss Fairlie's muslin dress. "Listen to the last sentences of the letter," said Miss Halcombe. "I think they will surprise you." As she raised the letter to the light of the candle, Miss Fairlie turned from the balustrade, looked doubtfully up and down the terrace, advanced a step towards the glass doors, and then stopped, facing us. Meanwhile, Miss Halcombe read me the last sentences to which she had referred. "And now, my love, seeing that I am at the end of my paper, now for the real reason, the surprising reason, for my fondness for Miss Anne Catherick. My dear Philip, although she is not half so pretty, she is, nevertheless, by one of those extraordinary caprices of accidental resemblance which one sometimes sees, the living likeness in her hair, her complexion, the color of her eyes, and the shape of her face." I started up from the ottoman before Miss Halcombe could pronounce the next words, a thrill of the same feeling which ran through me when the touch was laid upon my shoulder on the lonely high road chilled me again. There stood Miss Fairlie, a white figure, alone in the moonlight, in her attitude, in the turn of her head, in her complexion, in the shape of her face, the living image, at that distance and under those circumstances, of the woman in white. The doubt which troubled my mind for hours and hours past flashed into conviction in an instant, that something wanting was my own recognition of the ominous likeness between the fugitive from the asylum and my pupil at Limeridge House. "You see it," said Miss Halcombe. She dropped the useless letter, and her eyes flashed as they met mine. "You see it now, as my mother saw it 11 years since." "I see it, more unwillingly than I can say. To associate that forlorn, friendless, lost woman, even by an accidental likeness only, with Miss Fairlie, seems like casting a shadow on the future of the bright creature who stands looking at us now. Let me lose the impression again as soon as possible. Call her in, out of the dreary moonlight. Pray call her in." "Mr. Hartwright, you surprise me. Whatever woman may be, I thought that men, in the 19th century, were above superstition." "Pray call her in." "Hush, hush. She is coming of her own accord. Say nothing in her presence. Let this discovery of the likeness be kept a secret between you and me. Come in, Laura, come in, and wake Mrs. Vesey with the piano. Mr. Hartwright is petitioning for some more music, and he wants it this time of the lightest and liveliest kind. Thus concludes this week's episode of The Woman in White by Wilkie Collins. We'll continue next week. On an administrative note, I wanted to say a few words about some of the opinions expressed by the author through this portion, specifically about nature. I believe Wilkie Collins is positioning nature as being unnatural, or at least the appreciation of nature is not natural to people until they study it as an art, and specifically mentions children not recognizing it. I almost see quite the opposite. When you're a child, you like to play outdoors. You stand transfixed, fascinated by a bug crawling in the grass, or just the feeling of the grass, or the sun, or just wondering about the sun. So I thought that was a rather interesting passage that he put in the words of Mr. Hartwright. And perhaps it was a product of the time period, which again was, he was a contemporary of Dickens. So perhaps that was something that was akin to that period. I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that. Or perhaps he was making just a statement of his own. I did think that was rather interesting. But of course there are other opinions which obviously are dated from that period. The character of Miss Halcombe, for instance. A comment on the blog expressed surprise at some of the attitudes towards women in another episode of the podcast. And I agree that it was quite surprising and harsh to hear in this day and age. I do think it's rather interesting because Miss Halcombe has a lot of contempt for women and expresses it quite bluntly. But at the same time, herself as a character is basically denying that stereotype of what she's saying. So she herself is an example of a woman who's outspoken and strong and enjoys supposedly activities that women would not enjoy. But then, of course, she's also putting every other woman down and making assumptions that all women are like the stereotype she's trying to say. So I thought that was rather interesting, but makes for an interesting character. Also kind of interesting way to read it, to perform it, when I'm reading her and imagining how she would be saying these words. Anyway, that's a little bit of commentary for me. I haven't made a deep analysis of this, so just a little bit of off-the-cuff impressions. And we'll be continuing next week, so I think we'll be in for a few more surprises about The Woman in White, which it seems now there are two women wearing white. So we'll see more next week, and thanks for listening.